the temperatures and the sea ice in Alaska have really moved into new territory in the last few years.
A leaked federal report paints a dire picture of climate change hitting the United States. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, in a rare move, Fish and Game is shutting down king salmon fishing across Southeast.
It is all directed at doing whatever we possibly can to preserve those kings that we anticipate are going to be in short supply in 2018.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
A new government report warns that regions across the U.S. are feeling the effects of rapid climate change, with some of the greatest effects in Alaska and the Arctic. The report states the evidence that human activity is driving climate change is stronger than ever. A draft of the assessment was leaked to the New York Times, which reported that scientists are worried the Trump administration might try to change or suppress it. The report says it is extremely likely that human activity is the dominant cause of recent warming, adding there is no convincing alternative explanation. That contradicts statements from Trump administration officials and from the president himself. The report is part of the National Climate Assessment, which is released every 4 years. John Walsh is with the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
It's a distillation of the latest information about climate change as it affects the United States.
Walsh contributed to the chapter on Alaska and the Arctic. He says the region has seen changes even in the short time since the last report 4 years ago.
The temperatures and the sea ice in Alaska have really moved into new territory in the last few years.
Since 2014, Alaska has seen three of its warmest years ever and record low sea ice. The report concludes it's virtually certain that human activity has contributed to the loss of sea ice and glaciers, declining snow cover, and rapidly increasing temperatures across the Arctic. And it states that changes in the region could have effects on the climate around the globe. Walsh says whatever fears scientists may have, he's seen no political interference in the report to date.
There was no attempt to steer the report one way or another. Scientists were free to express express what they thought.
The Trump administration is supposed to review and formally approve the report later this month. A bill targeting the problem of plastic waste in the ocean and other marine debris cleared the U.S. Senate last week. It is sponsored by Alaska's Senator Dan Sullivan.
What is particularly troubling about the marine debris challenge and crisis, and we believe it's absolutely a crisis, is that the majority of marine debris in the world's oceans come from five countries in Asia: China, Thailand, the Philippines, Vietnam, Indonesia, and South Korea.
The bill would call on the State Department to engage other countries to find solutions. It would also reauthorize the marine debris program for another 5 years with up to $10 million per year. Kevin Alexson of the Ocean Conservancy calls the bill small but significant. Small, he says, because it's the first item on the to-do list, and significant because it could unleash the power of the State Department to tackle the problem at the source, where much of the pollution comes from.
To engage with those countries, you know, bilaterally, multilaterally, to begin a dialogue or continue a dialogue that is really kind of in its infancy right now on what to do.
At a hearing on the bill last month, Sullivan asked why five countries account for such a large share of the problem. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State David Balton describes it as a casualty of rapid growth.
I think the simple answer to that, Senator, is that their pace of economic development is just moving ahead so much more rapidly than their waste management capabilities. So to get a handle on this, we really need to help them improve waste management processes.
The bill's 21 co-sponsors span the ideological spectrum, including conservative Republican Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma and far to his left, Democrat Cory Booker of New Jersey. Booker praised the bipartisanship, but says the situation is more dire than most people realize. He cited massive growth in the production of plastics and the unabated use of the material for packaging.
This is a crisis of global proportions, and we're acting as if the little teeny bit that we're doing is somehow going to stop our grandchildren from experiencing a world where there is more plastic in our oceans than all of the fish and marine wildlife.
Booker and others say the problem isn't just the fault of faraway countries. Nancy Wallace directs the Marine Debris Program for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. She confirmed the top five contributors of marine debris are in Asia.
But the United States is number 20, and we are the number one generator of waste in the world. So we are contributing to this problem.
The bill passed the Senate by unanimous consent without a roll call vote. Alaska Congressman Don Young sponsored an identical version in the House. It has also attracted a raft of co-sponsors from both parties, but has no hearings scheduled yet. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is shutting down all commercial and sport fishing for king salmon in southeast Alaska. The dual emergency order is unprecedented in recent memory. As of 12:01 a.m. this Thursday, all commercial fishing boats, guided charter boats, and residential recreational fishermen must release any king salmon unharmed. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The order will be reevaluated at the end of September when the department could either extend it or lift it. Commercial trawlers wrapped up their first summer opener in only 4 days in July, landing 66,000 kings. That left 31,000 kings to be caught in a second opener, which usually happens sometime in August. However, poor ocean survival and record low returns to home river systems are causing managers great concern over the health of this year's Chinook run. They're looking past this year to the future of the fishery. This is Deputy Commissioner of ADF&G Charlie Swanton. He says many of the kings in the ocean at present are younger and will spawn next year and later.
Since a large number of the kings that we get during the second opening are what we consider to be feeder kings, we felt compelled to do as much as we could to look towards the future in terms of those stocks. And it doesn't look all that, you know, ocean conditions and such don't look all that promising for 2018. And we want to do whatever we can to turn around and try and not replicate 2017 moving forward in 2018 and beyond.
The sport closure comes as the summer charter season remains in full swing. Although many areas of Southeast were closed to king retention earlier in the summer, a region-wide closure is rare. Again, poor production in Alaska rivers is to blame, and Swanton wants to make sure there is a sport harvest next year.
And it is all, you know, directed at doing whatever we possibly can to preserve those kings, you know, that we anticipate are going to be in short supply in 2018.
Both the commercial and sport fisheries for king salmon are carefully regulated under an agreement with Canada called the Pacific Salmon Treaty. In addition to locally produced fish, large numbers of kings caught by Alaskan fishermen in the summer openers originate outside of state waters. So the treaty plus Alaska's commitment to sustainable salmon fisheries policy are the primary management directives driving the closure. It is imperative that Alaska offer relief now for these stocks, says Deputy Commissioner Swanton, with a focus on protecting future production. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Canadian authorities have closed the Alaska Highway at the point near the Rancheria Lodge in the Yukon Territory, where a fuel tanker wrecked and overturned last night. The truck pulling two tanks went off the road around milepost 686, about 77 miles west of Watson Lake. The CBC is reporting at least one tank ruptured, but the amount of fuel spilled wasn't immediately available. The Yukon Department of Highways and RCMP have been at the scene all day. A highway spokesperson says the fuel truck was pulling two tankers when it went off the road, with at least one tanker rupturing. The RCMP says the driver was taken to a hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. As Philippe Morin reports from Teslin, the closure has caused a big backup of traffic.
Dude, I'll sleep right on the ground.
People waited hours today along the Alaska Highway. They waited for any news about the road closure and waited for their chance to be let through.
I don't think they really have an idea what they're doing yet. They haven't got a game plan.
The weather is beautiful today, and some people on vacation didn't seem to mind.
Oh, we're taking it well. We have chairs, as you see. We have food. We have shade. We're doing fine. We have people who are great here on the road as well.
Still, others were more worried.
How much are we carrying?
$136,000 worth.
Of salmon.
Yeah.
Okay.
As of this hour, the road is still closed. It's been almost 20 hours now. There's no word yet from Highways and Public Works as to how fast the spill can be cleaned up. Philippe Morin, CBC News, Teslin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, 56 tribes unite in the YK Delta around a new provisional government.
I see people losing hope. I see people in disparity. I see people struggling to even live in dignity.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Alaska Governor Bill Walker is getting some national recognition. Walker praised President Donald Trump's administration's approach to energy issues in a recent interview with the news organization Politico. Politico followed the interview with a story on Tuesday saying that Walker is an example for, quote, anti-Trump independence, unquote. On Politico's podcast called Off Message, Walker said that Trump's stated wish to achieve energy dominance and is good for Alaska.
The message is energy dominance are words that we like. We think that's good for us. It's good for the country. It's good for the balance of trade.
Walker laughed when podcast host Edward Isaac Dovier gave him a chance to declare whether he's running for president in 2020. But Walker says an independent could be elected president.
I think there's a desire for something other than the just the two brands that are there. So I think what's challenging a little bit for an independent, we have to sort of explain who we are.
Walker Communications Director Grace Jang raised concern with the way the story appeared online. The headline reads, "Anti-Trump independents are starting to organize," which was superimposed on a photo of Walker.
The Politico headline is misleading, and especially coupled with the photo of the governor, grossly inaccurate. So I have requested of Politico that they change their headline. And also, it's not reflective of the body of the reporter's story.
As of 4 p.m. today, the photo and headline remained. A forecasted weather shift is expected to cool interior temperatures this weekend. National Weather Service meteorologist Christopher Cox says a high-pressure system that's resulting in warmer-than-normal conditions is forecast to be pushed out later in the week.
Friday and into Saturday, we're expecting a strong cold front to sweep down from the high Arctic, move over the North Slope and over the Brooks Range, and move into the interior. It'll be cooling from the 70s and 80s of recent days into the 40s and 50s in the northern interior and into the upper 50s in the Fairbanks area by Sunday morning.
Cox says the system could also bring snow to some higher elevation areas.
Possibility of some snow in the Brooks Range as this front moves through. We're not anticipating snow at elevations here locally. There could possibly be some at Eielson Visitor Center at the higher elevations along the road in Denali.
It got up to 81 degrees at Fairbanks International Airport yesterday, the second day in a row with an 80-plus reading. It hit 83 on Sunday. Highs of 77 and 78 are forecast for Fairbanks today and tomorrow. provisional government was formed last week at the Bethel Cultural Center. KYUK's Christine Trudeau reports that over 3 days last week and many long discussions, a treaty was signed to form the Provisional Nunavut Alaska Government to unite the 56 village tribes of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta.
The third day of the Constitutional Conference saw a historic unanimous vote pass to sign the treaty with 10 designated tribal village representatives present.
It was 100% supported, and the idea is to promote self-determination, to have tribal autonomy and sovereignty. This is the beginning of a journey. This is the beginning of a marathon that started 40 years ago.
Nikki Hoffman, Nunavut secretary and former Bethel City Councilwoman. Hoffman says this couldn't come at a more important time for tribes of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta.
I see people losing hope. I see people in disparity. I see people struggling to even live in dignity, and we can't have that. We need to do more. We need to do better.
Sheridan Ipchuk is the chairman of the newly formed Provisional Nunavut Government, formed last week. Beyond lengthy discussions from everything to executive qualifications to education, Ipchuk says he stressed to many tribal village representatives that uniting would in no way take away current sovereign authority to their own communities, but rather unite all 56 villages as a regional tribal authority with the ability to mandate law.
The tribal members that were here and the people that came to witness the event gave Nunavut the direction and the powers that it need to get these things going that are needed.
With more discussions to come, a vote is set to take place on November 7th amongst all enrolled members of all 56 villages in the YK Delta. To ratify a working draft of their constitution, vote on an official name for the government, and vote officials into office. For KYUK News, I'm Christine Trudeau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
For the first time ever, there's some cell service along the Dalton Highway. GCI launched coverage late last month in the Coldfoot area. Company spokeswoman Heather Handyside says service is available in the vicinity of a tower constructed near mile 175 of the Dalton.
We've just completed a $500,000 cellular tower, and our customers on that area of the highway, probably about a 15-mile stretch around the tower, we'll be able to access calls, text, and also 3G data services.
Handyside says the tower is the first of several GCI is planning to construct over the next year and a half to 2 years to extend coverage along the 415-mile-long road between Live and Good and Dead Horse. The highway, which crosses the Yukon River and Arctic Circle, is a popular tourist route as well as year-round supply conduit for North Slope oil fields.
I believe this is the longest stretch of highway in America without cell coverage, so this will be a huge improvement to public safety for users of the highway, both travelers and the trucking companies who use it. I think there's over 250 trucks a day at times on the highway, so it's busy.
Mobile communication along the Dalton Highway or Hall Road is currently primarily via CB radio and satellite phone. Handyside says the addition of cell service along the Dalton is part of $30 million GCI is spending to expand coverage statewide. It's important to know where you come from, but when others make assumptions that are wrong, it's hard to maintain your identity. A Southeast Alaska Tlingit Tribal government is letting its neighbors know its members come from a vast territory that still bears their name. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The tour boat St. Peter sails around Douglas Island, which is part of Juneau, headed to nearby Taku Inlet. On board are a variety of government officials and members of the Douglas Indian Association. It represents the Taku Kwan, the area's original residents. At the front of the boat, leaders Paul Marks and David Katzik explain where they are in Tlingit and English.
You're hearing the words and the voices of those who have gone before us on these waters. And this is how we know today, and we've known for thousands of years, that this land belonged to us.
Traditional Taku Kwan territory includes the southeast part of Juneau, Taku Inlet, a smaller cove called Taku Harbor, and up the Taku River into Canada. The association also includes members of the Ak Kwan, whose traditional territory is to the north and west. As the boat crosses the border between the two clans, members of the Ateyi Tlingit dancers begin the Wushkitan love song. Westerners began exploring the area in the late 1800s and built mines and cities. Taku people lived nearby, but they weren't treated as the original property owners. They were shut out of traditional lands. A Tlingit cemetery was knocked down and paved to make room for a road and a school. Later, local government burned down their village to build a boat harbor. Tribal government administrator Andrea Cadiente-Lati says colonization, disease, limits on fishing, and other factors decimated the population.
So we lost everything that was precious to other tribes, federally recognized tribes, and that's land, fishing rights, community, all the way down to sacred sites.
The boat motors past Point Arden, where an inlet, a channel, and a passage meet. Katsik says the competing currents weave the waters, giving them their Tlingit title.
So the name is Kanasnuh. Everybody say the word, Kanasnuh. That is a powerful, powerful word. When you look into hydrology, if there's any kind of contamination going, this is the place where it would be mixing and it would be sending it out to the other places.
The Taku people are particularly worried about pollution from the long-closed Tulsiquitchief mine across the border in Canada. Acidic water drains from abandoned tunnels into the mine's namesake river. Some studies have shown it does not damage fisheries as it flows into the Taku River, but a recent British Columbia report points to unsafe pollutant levels in some areas. Entering Taku Inlet, the boat stops at a steep cliff face for a memorial and off a cove for another. There, and in a harbor to the south, speakers point out where the Taku Kwan once lived. Michael Kell, a historical archaeologist for the state, gestures towards an old cannery and the site of a long-abandoned fort. It's where the area's Tlingits established one of their many communities.
We know for a fact that there are summer and winter camps, for example, and these camps indicate that people were here and using the land. That's the important recognition here, is that the culture's been here and the culture's still here.
Old village sites are hard to spot, since most Taku people moved to town decades ago. Tribal administrator Cadiente-Lati says many are not part of the Douglas Indian Association. Leaders would like them to join.
Part of the challenge is to have other government agencies, the powers that be, that dictate where and when and how much funding comes to the tribe based on its membership, that it's not just the tribal member numbers, it's the area that was traditionally, historically, the tribes.
She says more members would increase government grants that fund economic development, environmental protection, and youth education. Reporting on board the catamaran St. Peter, I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
Thank you. Community gardens across Anchorage are buzzing with activity this summer. 12 new gardening plots have popped up in the Fairview area, built with help from a youth employment program. Alaska Public Media's Henry Leisha has been visiting community gardens across the city to learn how Anchorage Parks and Recreation is working to meet the needs of Alaska gardeners.
On a recent cloudy afternoon, David Parrish yanks weeds from a patch of dirt where he's been growing strawberries. He gardens barefooted, admiring an impressive harvest at a nearby plot run by a couple.
They fertilize like crazy. They've got something brewed up. I don't know what it is. And it just goes bananas. So yeah, I mean, you learn a lot from other people just by walking around, even if you don't ever see them.
Parrish maintains two plots at a community garden in Midtown, one of four such gardens run by Anchorage's Parks and Recreation Department. He has managed to reserve plots the past 5 years, but that is exceptionally lucky. Across the city, demand for plots is roughly twice the amount that's available, which has created long wait lists for would-be gardeners. Parrish says he would like to see more gardens closer to where he lives.
It's here in some places on the east side. There's none on the south side. There's none on the west side. So I think that would be the improvement. It's more options.
Parks and Rec is working to provide more gardening spaces. At East 8th and Carluck, near the Fairview neighborhood, a group of teenagers has been busy building 12 new raised beds. The work crew is part of Youth Employment in Parks, or YEP, a program that hires Anchorage teens to complete park improvement projects.
All right, guys, one more!
Margaret Timmerman, the community garden coordinator for Anchorage Parks and Rec, was on site to supervise construction of the new beds. She says that instead of creating new gardens in other areas of Anchorage, she is focusing on expanding the number of plots at existing gardens.
You know, Field of Dreams, we will build it and they will come. You really have to make sure that's going to happen.
Although the municipality owns over 11,000 acres of parkland, it can be difficult to find areas that have the right combination you need for a successful community garden. Decent growing conditions with access to water and public transportation. 2 years ago, a professor at the University of Alaska in Anchorage created a community garden survey to help the Parks and Rec Department understand residents' needs. The results showed that the greatest need exists in East Anchorage, where there's less space for private gardens next to people's homes. But the east side of town is where most of the city's community gardens are already located. According to Professor Shannon Donovan, who ran the survey, there's still a high demand from residents in the south and west parts of town, where many homes do have space for private gardens.
The city kind of needs to decide if they want to do both, look in putting in gardens in places where there aren't as many versus putting in more gardens where there's been a real need and interest expressed.
Then there's the issue of funding.
Most of the people who rent garden plots, it's about $25 a year, right? So it's not covering the cost.
Cook Inlet Housing Authority, Anchorage Community Land Trust, and Catholic Social Services currently manage and maintain three of the city's community gardens, which cuts costs for the municipality. Donovan says that these kinds of partnerships are essential for expanding the number of community gardens. Soon, a sizable dent will be made in the wait list for community garden plots. Anchorage Parks and Recreation recently received a federal grant to help develop Muldoon Town Square Park in East Anchorage. Next year, they plan to build a community garden with 50 plots in the new park. In Anchorage, I'm Henry Leisha.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Rachel Waldholz and Henry Leisha in Anchorage, Ed Schoenfeld and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Christine Trudeau in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Philip Morin in Teslin. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Zachariah Hughes produced tonight's program. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ExxonMobil Alaska. Their financial investment and partnership with local companies at Point Thompson helps contribute to Alaska's economy and jobs for Alaskans. ExxonMobil, energy lives here.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.